We're on the one from last week, and we're in Job chapter 25. Let's back up to Job chapter 19. We're actually on page 4 of the notes at the top of the page, and again, that's the notes from last week. We've got some to finish up there before we go into the new one. I want to just back up to Job chapter 19. We finished on this last week, and it's a good picking up point. Job, of course, had gone through these dialogues. The first dialogue actually was with Eliphaz, and then Job gives an answer to that, and we studied it in that order. Bildad was the second friend that came along and put his 2 cents worth in. Job then gave an answer to that, and that's presently what we are dealing with. Was Job's answer. And Job 19, verse 23, "Oh, that my words were now written. Oh, that they were penned in a book." He didn't know that we would have them as we have them today, and that was his desire, but it was also God's desire, "that they were graven with an iron pen and lead in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh I shall see God, which is resurrection, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another, though my reins be consumed within me." Which is an amazing testimony, actually, that Job would declare that. He literally is talking about the fact of death and resurrection. He's talking about the fact that Christ is our Redeemer, in verse 25, and at the latter day he will stand upon the earth, which is so plainly given throughout Scripture as it is revealed. But remember, Job didn't have the Scriptures like we have to read, and yet the Holy Spirit of God revealed this information to him. So that was an amazing testimony as he gave that answer to Bildad in particular. Now in chapter 25, we have actually Bildad's third debate. Each one of them had a segment, and then Job would answer, and then it would be another segment. In this case, this is the third time that Bildad actually carries on his, what I would call, a diatribe against Job. And as I've labeled it here, Bildad misunderstood Job's view of the sovereignty of God. And so in chapter 25 and verse 4, Bildad said, "How then can man be justified with God? Or how can he be clean that is born of a woman?" So basically, he was irritated at Job. And his conclusion was, "Well, Job, if you haven't sinned, why are you having this problem? How do you justify this?" He was thinking that a justified man didn't have such problems. That really is a fallacy in thinking. To think that because a person is saved and because you live righteously that you're not going to have any troubles or trials or difficulties, that's poor thinking, but that was the thinking, really, of Job's friends, that the reason he was having this problem was because he was sinning, or at least they indicated he had some hidden sin, and that was the accusation against him. So again, that was Bildad's question to him in verse 4. Then in verse 6, "How much less man that is a worm, and the son of man which is a worm?" And what he was saying there, man is just basically like a worthless worm if he is not blessed somehow for righteous living. So again, he's basically coming down to that same thing, that if a man is righteous, he's going to be blessed. If he's not blessed, that means he's not righteous. And so he was accusing Job of that. Now, his third argument here obviously is very short in 6 verses. So when you come to chapter 26, then Job responds, but Job's response is not real short, but some interesting things in his response. First of all, in verse 7, chapter 26, verse 7, "He stretcheth out the north over the empty place and hangeth the earth upon nothing." And again, that really is an interesting statement, and how true that is. God is sovereign. He created the earth. He basically hung it upon nothing. You know, what an observation. What Job is saying is so true. He hung the whole thing out there in the middle of nowhere. And that's It's fascinating. You know, it always baffles me how you can think that somehow there was this big bang and things happened and somehow then life came out of that. When you look at the universe, and it's just fascinating, you have all of these bodies up there and they aren't running into each other. They each have their pattern of things of which they do. And that was interesting being in the planetarium down there the other day. And they show a lot of it. You have to carefully don't get dizzy, but you lean back in your chair and all this is going on in the ceiling. And they give you all this information. They show the planets and how they orbit and things. And that's what Job was talking about here in particular, how this happens. He stretcheth out the north over the empty place and hangeth the earth upon nothing. You know, it's just amazing. How can you possibly have all this going on and yet it doesn't fall apart? It's just amazing. But Job, again, understood God. He didn't understand why he was going to this conflict, but he did understand God is the creator, and he did not deny that. He did not turn against God. He did not rebel against God. Even in his difficulty, he observed things that were so true. I'll drop down to verse 13. By his spirit he hath garnished the heavens. His hand hath formed the crooked serpent. And of course, you go back to the early chapters of Genesis when the Spirit of God, it says, moved upon the face of the deep. We know also that it says in the New Testament that Jesus declared that he was the creator. And so we know that God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit, all three of them were involved in creation. But we know by his Spirit he hath garnished the heavens. And that's, again, very interesting how he garnished or he decorated the heavens. One of the bad things of spending 30-some years in Milwaukee is that rarely in Milwaukee do you ever see a star. There's so much light that you can't see it. And it was always a delight to go out in the country. In fact, we used to go up to Camp Fairwood, and that's the first thing that always stunned me. Not that I didn't know it, but I just loved to go out at night when it's pitch black and very little lights around. You look up and just, you know, it's just millions and billions of stars and planets or whatever name you want to give them, but it's all decorated. And, you know, we pick out things, the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper, and then they have these other constellations that somebody has named, and, you know, they're always there. There's this pattern, it was designed, it was created, and Job observed that. And so what you really have is Job's attitude. Now, you're talking about a man, lost everything he had, lost every one of his children. He was physically ill with these sores on his body, but he still recognized and understand who God was, that God was in control, that God was sovereign in these things that he did. But he garnished, he decorated the heavens. Possibly his hand that formed the crooked serpent is probably referring actually to some constellation that they had referred to it as that particular name. But Job recognized these things as from God's creation. Then jump to chapter 27. Again, we're just kind of hitting some highlights. Verse 4 through 6. My lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. God forbid that I should justify you till I die. I will not remove mine integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me so long as I live. So with all of the accusations that Job's friends made against him, he never turned in bitterness away from God. He didn't blame God. He didn't curse God. Remember, Job's wife said, why don't you just curse God and die and give it up? But he didn't do that. And this is quite a testimony. My lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. He said, I am not going to speak anything against God. God forbid that I should justify you. He's talking to Bildad here. Till I die, I will not remove mine integrity from me. And really, that's the point of life, our integrity, our spiritual integrity, to not lose that in all of your life. And I know it's not fun to be sick. And you have to, again, think about Job and the position he was in and realize, he said, I may be sick, I may have lost everything, but he said, I will not lose my integrity. My righteousness, verse 6, I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me so long as I live. He said, I am not going to let that go. That was his determination, which I think, again, is a real help and encouragement to us to realize you may go through some difficult things in life, but don't give up your integrity with God. He would maintain that till the day he died. Verse 19 through 23, the rich man shall lie down, but he shall not be gathered. He openeth his eyes, and he is not. Tares take hold on him as waters. The tempest stealeth him away in the night. The east wind carrieth him away, and he departeth, and as a storm hurleth him out of his place. For God shall cast upon him and not spare. He would fain flee out of his hand. Men shall clap their hands at him and shall hiss him out of his place. And basically what he's talking about here is that God may take from the rich. Men may clap their hands and whistle, but he said he would not turn from God. Job had been a rich man, but was no longer. Chapter 28 and verse 12, but where shall wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Job was simply asking where wisdom could be found. Where is the understanding located? Verse 15, chapter 28. It cannot be gotten for gold, neither shall silver be weighed for price thereof. So wisdom is not something that can be bought with gold or silver or material things. So basically what it comes down to is that material wealth is not a sign that one possesses wisdom. Just because a person may be wealthy doesn't make them necessarily a wise person. A person could be very poor and still be wise. Chapter 28, verse 23, God understandeth the way thereof. He knoweth the place thereof. So God's wisdom comes from God. God knows the source of wisdom and how to find it. And verse 28, and unto man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. So the fear of the Lord really is where wisdom is found. In the notes I printed for you, Proverbs 1:7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Or Proverbs 9:10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but knowledge and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. And that's the same thing that Job was declaring. Chapter 29, verse 2, oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God preserved me. And Job obviously wished that somehow he could be back where it was before when everything was going right. He acknowledged that his earlier prosperity basically had come from God. And in verse 4, as I was in the days of my youth, when the secret of God was upon my tabernacle. And again, he's basically wishing, boy, it'd be nice if I could be back and be a youth again. But obviously, we don't have the choice of going back and doing that. Verse 5, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were about me, indicating again, if I could just go back when I was a younger man and the kids were all home yet and we were a happy family, and he said, it'd be nice if you could go back to that. Then in verse 29, 21, unto me men gave ear and waited and kept silence at my counsel, which indicates that back when everything was going well and he was prospering, there were people that came to him for counsel because he was a man of great wisdom. Now, however, people didn't come to him for counsel because he'd lost everything. Jumping to chapter 30 and verse 1, but now they are younger than I. They that are younger than I have me in derision, whose fathers I would have disdained to have set with the dogs of my flock. Now, basically, he said the younger no longer respected him, which indicates that these three friends in particular, and later the fourth one, Elihu, but Eliphaz and each one of his friends came against Job and ridiculed him. They didn't respect him. This likely included them because they were younger, and they thought they had figured out life. And they figured they knew the answer to Job's problems. Verse 10. They abhor me. They flee far from me and spare not to spit in my face. So they literally ran from him. I don't know if it's referring to his four friends that spit in his face. It might have been others that saw him and knew at one time he was a rich man, and so they ridiculed him and spit in his face. I don't know exactly, but evidently somebody did. The low-lifers of society made mockery of him because at one time he was a very affluent man and very well recognized. In chapter 31 and verse 6, "Let me be weighed in an even balance that God may know mine integrity." So he was reeling. He said, "Let God judge me. God is the judge." He said, "I'm willing to be put in the balances of God." It's interesting to see how after many accusations by his friends, he finally comes to his own defense, which basically is, "I didn't do anything wrong. I am not guilty of some hidden sin." And he defends himself. In the rest of the chapter, he accounts many things he did, such as the fact that he fed the poor. In chapter 31, verse 39 and 40, "If I have eaten the fruits thereof without money, or have caused the owners thereof to lose their life, let thistles grow instead of wheat and cockle instead of barley, the words of Job are ended." If he was guilty of a particular sin, he said, "Let thistles grow instead of wheat." If he was guilty of any such sin, let him be judged. He thus rested his case. And his second friend was as bad as the first. Bildad was convinced also that Job and his children had sinned, so they deserved this judgment. It's interesting to see how Job did not understand why God chose this for him, but he could see the hope of resurrection. There was more to life than material things like the lost. There was an eternity. So Job comes to some very good conclusions from the experiences of which he had. Moving now to the next section we just passed out this morning, we're going to talk about Zophar, which, again, it's not a whole lot different than the other two friends, Eliphaz and Bildad. Zophar's arguments pretty much come down the same line. "Well, Job, you know you sin, that's why you have the problem." But again, we're going to note that starting out with. And so we got to back up to chapter 11. Now, bear in mind, I did explain that to you when we started this series, that what I've done is I've taken each man and their arguments and Job's answer and put them together. They're actually mixed in there, but I've put them together for sake of organizing in that fashion. And then, of course, we're just picking up some of the highlights. So Zophar confronts Job as simple-minded, chapter 11 and verse 2. "Should not the multitude of words be answered, and should a man full of talk be justified?" And basically, he accused Job of a lot of talk. "You're full of hot air." He accused Job of being full of hot air. Wasn't exactly a nice accusation. Verse 3, "Should thy lips make men hold their peace? And when thou mockest, shall no man make thee ashamed?" So he basically called Job a liar. He intimated that Job mocked God by claiming to be upright because he claimed he was righteous. He said, "You're mocking God." Why would he say that? Because his conclusion, "Job, you're not righteous. You're unrighteous. God is judging you." Chapter 11, verse 4, "For thou hast said, my doctrine is pure, I am clean in thine eyes." That was Job's answer. But he was angry because Job said that he was pure. He accused Job of being a hypocrite. "You say you're pure, but you really aren't." Again, that was a false accusation. Verse 5, "But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee." He was actually wishing that God would speak from heaven. He would speak and condemn Job. Zophar piously began to assume that he knew how God would respond. In verse 6, "And that he would show thee the secrets of wisdom, that they are double to that which is. Know therefore that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserveth." As far as he was concerned, God had not even exacted of Job what he really deserved. As far as Zophar was concerned, Job deserved even worse than what he'd already experienced. I'm not sure how you could make it much worse. The only last thing left was death, and that wouldn't have been so bad. Job actually wished for that. So to come up with such a crazy idea that, well, it should be worse punishment when he really lost everything. So I don't think the man was using his head at all. In verse 14, If iniquity be in thine hand, put it away, and let not wickedness dwell in thy tabernacle. So again, he basically is assuming that Job deserved judgment. He wasn't righteous like he claimed. He evidently had sinned. He deserved judgment. He implied there was sin in Job's life, so he needed to put it away. The principle, of course, is this is true, but the problem was that wasn't Job's problem. He didn't have this difficulty because he'd sinned. There was other reasons for it. It was because God was allowing Satan to do this to him. So he was really falsely accusing him. Verse 15. For then shalt thou lift up thy face without spot, yea, thou shalt be steadfast and shall not fear. So only after Job repented, God would lift up him again. He would lift up his face to God. If Job had sinned, that would be true. But the problem again, he was accusing him of something that was not true. Job had not sinned. Now, Job gives his defense in chapter 12, verse 3. But I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Yea, who knoweth not such things as these? In the beginning, I think Job was quite contrite, but after listening to his friends, it comes to a point now he actually does defend himself. And verse 3 does a good job of it. He did not let Zophar or the others run roughshod over him. He also had understanding and was in no way inferior to them. He is now standing up and defending himself. In verse 4 of chapter 12, I am as one mocked of his neighbor, who calleth upon God, and he answereth him. The just, upright man is laughed to scorn. So he basically said, I'm being mocked by my neighbors. And this was three of them. They weren't comforting him. They were mocking him. He called upon God and received answers. But Job did not believe that. Or Zophar did not believe that. In verse 5, Job says, he that is ready to slip with his feet is as a lamp despised in the thought of him that is at ease. And it's worded a little strange, but basically I think what it's saying is those who are at ease did not try to help him when he's like a man holding a lamp and his feet were slipping. He was about to drop the lamp. He was in despair, but his friends did not help him, but rather they condemned him. In verse 6, the tabernacles of robbers prosper, and they provoke God. They that provoke God are secure, into whose hand God bringeth abundantly. And he uses again another explanation. He said, look, there are thieves, there are robbers, there are people that steal. They prosper. Isn't that true? It is true. So because someone prospers doesn't mean they have God's blessing. So Job was trying to get him to think through. Look, you're accusing me of something that is really not true. Because someone prospers, they may be from God's blessing, but it might not be God's blessing. The robbers, they prosper. Verse 12, with the ancient is wisdom, and in the length of days, understanding. So wisdom does come with age. So Job was not about to be put down by his younger friends. Wisdom also does come from God, the ancient one. Verse 14, behold, he breaketh down, and it cannot be built again. He shutteth up a man, and there can be no opening. God can break down, and it can never be rebuilt if he so chooses. And so Job was coming to some very good conclusions here. He said, look, God can take away everything if he chooses. And Job was defending himself. That's why everything had been taken. Verse 15, behold, he withholdeth the waters, and they dry up. Also he sendeth them out, and they overturn the earth. God can withhold rain and create drought. God can send too much rain and create a flood. He can do whatever he chooses to do. And what Job was trying to say is, look, the reason I'm in this situation is because this is what God has chosen. He had a very good grasp of the sovereignty of God and God's control. And he understood that. He had examined his life. He knew the problem was not sin. Verse 23, he increaseth the nations and destroyeth them. He enlargeth the nations and straighteneth them again. And basically what he is saying there, and that's taught other places in Scripture as well, that God sets up nations, God takes down nations. And we know that to be true. I know that the political stuff gets a little frustrating to us, does it not? But I do sometimes have to just remind myself and not get frustrated by it and realize God is in control. He sets up nations, he takes down nations. But if God sets up nations and he takes down nations, does he care about people? It's the same. That's his application. If God does it to nations, he can do that to people. He can take what we have or he can give to us. God can do either one. He can set us up, he can take us down. And in Job's case, what did God do? He set him up and then he took him down. Chapter 13, verse 2. What ye know, the same do I know also. I am not inferior unto you. Again, he's defending himself. He said, look, you don't have anything over on me. I'm not inferior to you. I don't have to sit here and listen to this, what you're trying to tell me, and you don't know what you're talking about. Verse 3, surely I will speak to the Almighty and desire to reason with God. He did talk and reason with God. Job could take his trouble to God and not to his miserable friends. He knew that he could talk to God. That's where the answer was. Verse 4, but ye are forgers of lies, ye are all physicians of no value. So he called them forgers of lies or physicians of no value. They were quack doctors. Verse 13, hold your peace, let me alone that I may speak, and let come on me what will. So again, he asked to be left alone. His thought was, let God deal with me, but you stay out of it. Not a bad argument. Verse 15, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him, but I will maintain mine own ways before him. And that again is a very good testimony. Even if God took his life, he said, I get right down to the wire. He said, I'm still going to trust the Lord. He was not guilty of their accusations, and he knew it, and he defended himself. Verse 16, he also shall be my salvation, for an hypocrite shall not come before him. Job gave a very positive testimony here. He said, the Lord is my salvation. I think it goes back again to what we read there in chapter 19, where he talked about eternity and resurrection. He said, the Lord is my salvation. In the Old Testament, you know, it does not delineate salvation so clearly as it does in the New Testament, where it says, for whosoever should call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. And the Old Testament just is not clear and things like that. And yet, here was Job, indicating, give his own testimony in particular, he also is my salvation, indicating that he knew his eternity was in God's hands. God was his salvation. He knew who his Savior was. A hypocrite would not have that kind of a relationship with God. That's what they were accusing him of. Verse 26, for thou writest bitter things against me, and makest me to possess the iniquities of my youth. So Zophar had put bitter accusations against Job. He brought up his youthful days when perhaps he did sin. But he said, you know, that's in the past. He said, I maybe did things when I was in my youth that weren't right. Typically, that's not so uncommon. But he said, that's past. That has nothing to do with the present. Job continued on in chapter 14, verse 1. Man is born of a woman, is a few days and full of trouble. And basically what Job was saying, life is short and can be full of trouble. This parable is equally true today. Life is short and full of trouble. I don't suppose anybody sitting here could say that every day that you live, that everything just goes real peachy. It's just not like that. And the other thing is how true that is that life is short. Sometimes when I think about it, I wonder, I don't know where it all went. I don't know how I got here. In my mind, things just have gone so fast. And yet, yeah, it's been difficult as long as wait. That's typical. That's normal. That's what Job saw in particular. Life is short and it's full of trouble. That's a true statement. There are difficulties. And the other thing, I think you can connect with that, when God saved us, it was not a promise that you'd never have a problem, never have a trial. We like to think that, but somehow that now that we're saved, we'd never have a problem, but that is not the case. And so his statement really is very accurate. Verse 2, he cometh forth like a flower, he is cut down, he fleeth also as a shadow, and continueth not. And again, he's comparing his life here like a flower. It comes up, it's beautiful, it blooms, and then all of a sudden it's cut down. My opinion, the summer doesn't last long enough. I enjoy the flowers, and I know men aren't supposed to do that, right? But you can say what you want to, God created the flowers. I think they're beautiful. I think they're fascinating. I just love to see how they grow, how they develop. Every one of them is so different, just fascinating. And all of a sudden, now we got to have frost. You know, it's all gone. But that's the way life is. It's like a flower. You start out young and beautiful, and all of a sudden, frost comes, it's all over. One's life is like a shadow. Also, the other illustration, the shadow is there, but the thing keeps moving, and first thing you know, it's gone. And that's the way life is. It's like a shadow. Verse 7, "For there is hope of a tree, if it be cut down, that it will sprout again, and that the tender branch thereof will not cease." And I think what Job was doing here is he actually realized the position he was in, that God could change that if he chooses. He said it's like a tree. He said you can have a beautiful tree, and there's some trees in particular, you can cut them down, and first thing you know, there's a little sprout that comes back up, and the tree's still alive. What Job was saying, I still have the hope that God will let that tree sprout again. So even in his desperation, he did not give up on what God was doing in particular. He knew that there was hope there and it could blossom again. And verse 10, he says, "But man dieth and wasteth away. Yea, man giveth up the ghost, and where is he?" So at the same time, he saw man dying and wasting away. And it is true that when a man dies, it's all over. He will not be rejuvenated. Someday resurrected, yes, but this life is not going to be rejuvenated. And in verse 14, "If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come." What did Job see? The same thing he saw back in chapter 19. Job believed in a resurrection. No matter what happened in this life, he waited for that day. If God chose to put him in the grave, that was all right because he believed in resurrection. And I remind you of 1 Corinthians 15:52, "In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall all be changed." That's not just a New Testament doctrine, is it? Job, somehow, by God giving him, breathing into him by inspiration this information, he believed in life after death. He believed in the resurrection. I'm going to stop there. It's a good breaking point, but let me back up to the one about cutting down the tree and sprout coming forward. And I know I've told you the story before, but some of you would have missed it. When we bought our house on the east side, you live in a place like that, there's very little yard. But we did have a little yard right along Maryland Avenue. And because I grew up at home when we had fruit trees right in our yard, apple trees and cherry trees, so I bought a little cherry tree and bought a little apple tree and planted them right there in the front yard right by the bus stop. But the little cherry tree, well, the apple tree did well too, but the little cherry tree that first year it came up, little bitty thing when I bought it, but in that first year that thing come up, got about that high, perfectly nice, beautifully shaped tree, and it actually had, I can't remember now, it was 20 or 22 cherries. I counted every one of them. I was watching it because I didn't expect to get cherries probably for years, but it had cherries that first year on there. Beautiful little tree, and they were about to the point they were starting to ripen, but we got up one morning, and my wife looked out the kitchen window, and she said, "Honey, somebody ruined your tree." And I looked out there, and sure enough, the stalk of that tree was about that big. Somebody had stripped the branches off, twisted that trunk of that tree around like that, and totally ruined it. I thought, well, I'll dig it up. I'll go buy another tree. And I got to thinking about that. I went to my office that morning and got to thinking about it. And you know, that tree has roots. So later that day, I cut the tree off, left a stump up about that high. I cut it off, but every morning I'd get up and get ready and walk over to the office, and I'd take a look at that stump. Every day, I didn't miss. I don't know how long it took, but finally one day, I saw this little purple bud on the edge of that trunk, and eventually I think there were several of them. But as they grew up, a little sprig came up out of that trunk. And so all the others I cut off and just kept the top one. And eventually it made a tree. And we got tons of cherries off of there. My wife used to make pies, put them in the freezer when we had missionaries, we had evangelists, when we had speakers and we fixed dinner for them, she made cherry pie. So I scheduled a lot of speakers. That's the only way I could get the cherry pie. But we enjoyed that. But it's just interesting how that stump was there. It was cut off. But the life is still there. And that was what Job said. I've been cut off. But the life is still there. May God somehow bring that back. And of course, we know in the story of Job, God did bring it back and gave him much more in the end. But the beautiful part is still the fact that he saw the hope of the change after this. Resurrection, there is life after this. And I think that's the thing you have to always keep in mind. You may go through some terrible trials. It may be cancer and death. But someday, resurrection, and forever a new body with the Lord. That's great.